Welcome to the JPGN Journal Club, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely and Dr. Jake Mann.
Hello, folks. Me and, most importantly, or more importantly, Dr. Jake Mann, leading JPGN Journal Club, here again for August. As always, keep in mind ESPGAN's other educational offerings. You can find them at https://www.espgan.org Knowledge Center. That's Knowledge-Center. In particular, on the 12th of September for an AHP Summer School, the 21st of September for the Young Investigator Forum, the 25th of September for the 5th Liver Transplant School, and breaking into October for the 25th, a monothematic conference on pediatric gastric disease. For today's discussion, Jake has chosen, one, a case review series of inflammatory bowel disease manifest after non-hematologic transplantation from JPGN by Wenzel et al., and from JHEP Reports by Scarby et al., a long-term follow-up of children with autoimmune sclerosing cholangitis, which, instead of calling it autoimmune sclerosing cholangitis, they have chosen to call primary sclerosing cholangitis. I don't hold with this. I spent 15 years working alongside Diego Vergani and Georgina Miaila Vergani, and it's AISC, and that's the end of that. When you get into being an adult, then you can have PSC, but not until your autoimmune sclerosing cholangitis childhood phase is over. At any rate, Jake, tell us why you thought the JPGN article, why you think the JPGN article is worth discussing here.
I guess it's another one of these cases where I saw a case series pop up, which was something that seemed totally unfamiliar to me, and I wanted to dig into what these authors had described and to see what they had to say about it. Post-transplant inflammatory bowel disease seems like an unusual entity, the appearance of a de novo IBD following solid organ transplantation in patients who were already immunosuppressed. And I thought that it would be interesting to really go into the details of how they defined these cases, what kind of immunosuppression they were on, what were their histological and endoscopic findings that led to this diagnosis.
I'm afraid you're doomed to disappointment in terms of histopathologic and endoscopic findings. They really don't go into that, and they certainly don't show any pictures. More to the point, I think, it's appropriate to be disappointed that in this retrospective study, they weren't able to study things such as T-cell subsets in even one or two of the eight children whom they describe. I think that these are certainly cases that are not part of Olson's standard Birds of Britain, if you remember the Monty Python sketch. They are rare birds indeed, and I suppose that it's useful to have a field guide to these rara avis, but I'm not sure what we learn other than this happens.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. So this is essentially a very large single center that has done 460 transplants over a 10-year period, and then they described eight patients who went on to develop de novo IBD. Their original solid organ transplants were predominantly isolated heart and kidney and liver, about a third each, 150 each. Also including some intestinal transplant patients, one of whom they described an intestinal transplant patient who then went on to get de novo IBD, which I guess to me, I just think that that would be such an unusual diagnosis to make in a patient who's had an intestinal transplant. Surely there would be an alternative explanation, such as a viral cause would be, or if though the description that they've given doesn't sound like rejection histologically to me, because they don't describe the presence of apoptoses, but we don't have the full details to really interrogate that.
They describe that particular patient's disease as fistulizing and speculate that it may have had a more Crohn-ish phenotype for that reason. I can't think of much else that goes on to form fistulae within the bowel than Crohn's disease. Can you?
No, other than chronic infection. And if these patients, I don't know this patient's detailed surgical history, but if they'd had previous perforations or needed re-laparotomy, whether that had led to fistulae, but true, that would not form multiple fistulae as you would see in Crohn's disease. I'm not sure that they described granulomas, though.
They certainly did not. All in all, I think, Jake, you and I are of the opinion that this is an interesting article and requires substantial revision before publication.
I think the main point for me is that all but one of the patients prior to their IBD diagnosis were on mycophenolate. And again, I acknowledge that the description of the histopathological changes were not typical for mycophenolate-associated colitis. However, I just find it surprising that several of these patients remained on mycophenolate following an IBD diagnosis, whereas I know that many centers would definitely stop the mycophenolate and try completely changing that prior to adding in additional immunosuppression, specifically for IBD.
They say in what is almost a rather offhand way, we excluded mycophenolate toxicity, and all of the eight patients whom we are dealing with had that ruled out. You're not so sure.
I guess I'm just surprised that these patients didn't have a complete stop of their mycophenolate on the basis of it, colitis being a common side effect of mycophenolate. Relatively common, at least. At least more than 8 out of 500. And then before making a new exceptionally rare diagnosis. I really appreciate these patients did have a raised calprotectin and a slightly raised, ever so subtly raised ESR. But I guess I just, I find it hard to come to terms with the diagnoses given the information provided with such a rarity. I think that it would be beneficial if the authors were able to provide almost individual patient level histopathological details and endoscopic images for allow us to really understand how these diagnoses have been made.
Well, Jake, now that you've read this, now that you are familiarized to a certain extent with this purported entity, what are you going to do with the next child who presents after solid organ transplantation with a gripey tummy and diarrhea?
I suppose we will bear this in mind at the as an absolute last resort, but until then, really would pursue all the other causes of abdominal pain and diarrhea in post-transplant patients and would need really highly convincing evidence to think that they had inflammatory bowel disease before we started giving them additional immunosuppression. But it is useful to know that this has been described.
So what about other aspects of working these patients up? Would you be doing any kind of genetic studies? Would you be doing any kind of T-cell distribution mapping?
I think the sort of patients where you might be considering looking at their genetics for inflammatory bowel disease would be those who have multiple other autoimmune conditions. And certainly in this group, a few of them did also have other autoimmune diseases. I'm not sure how one would interpret T-cell substats in making a diagnosis and whether that would really influence your form of treatment.
It might not, but they do speculate that a predisposition for this sort of disorder might be set up with long-term, early-onset administration of tacrolimus in toddlers and small children. I'm not sure that I buy that, but I take that. But if somebody is responding differently to inflammatory agents or antigens as a result of long-term tacrolimus exposure, well, how are you going to sort that out?
Yeah, I hear that point about that you're getting dysregulation of the T cell subsets. I'm again a little bit skeptical because in theory calcineurin inhibitors should be a relatively pan T cell immunosuppressant. Yes, in theory it's possible that you'd have some individuals which have a skewed response which allows their Th17 pathway to remain active even though you've then sort of immunosuppressed their inherent immunosuppressive pathways, which allows the emergence of a de novo autoimmune phenomenon. It makes sense, but...
But it's still wisps and clouds since they don't describe any particular data to support it, other than it could be on a basis of, well, some of ours were exposed to this, and what can you say? I think what we can say is it's available as a description of the entity, and the description needs substantial refinement before it can be considered well-established.
Sounds fair to me.
Right then. On we go to JHEP reports by Scarby et al., the long-term follow-up of children with autoimmune sclerosing cholangitis. More than 120 kids with AISC, all from a Swedish treatment center in Stockholm, and collected and followed for up to 21 years. Now, 124 children is a very respectable number of instances of a disorder occurring in 2 children per million. And what they found out with a median follow-up of 13 years was that long-term morbidity was low. 91% transplant-free survival at 10 years. Jake, these results surprised the study authors. Do they surprise you?
I think that with these studies, like many of the papers and case series we've talked about before, it is so dependent on what the individual referral patterns are in each country and hospital, which therefore determines the severity and stage that patients present, along with that, the exact selection criteria. Here, they have chosen to take all patients with a diagnosis of either large duct or isolated small duct PSC, as they've described it, and then said that's with or without autoimmune hepatitis, rather than taking all patients with any form of autoimmune liver disease in childhood, whether that be patients with chronic active hepatitis in the absence of bile duct injury or the presence of bile duct injury or not. And certainly the other reports, and in this report, they describe the fact that the patients with autoimmune hepatitis, in addition, as they have termed it, had poorer outcomes or earlier progression of their liver disease compared to those with no evidence of chronic active hepatitis on biopsy. So I think it is helpful to have a description to say that it is not necessarily quite as bad as some of the previous descriptions, but this doesn't mean that every cohort from every center will have the same outcomes as described here.
Do you know, when somebody says to me that a biopsy specimen contained from a child who carries a diagnosis of PSC contained no portal tract inflammation, well, my ears go up. I'm highly skeptical of that because in my experience, at any rate, there's always a little bit of something going on. At least at presentation, there certainly is always something going on. And the decision to call something, the decision to call a cholangiopathy PSC pure strikes me as, well, as questionable. Do you have a stance on that?
Well, I'm of the prevailing school that it is a spectrum of disease and depends what time you capture it. And there is data from a center not too far away, which has shown that patients with particularly type 1 autoimmune hepatitis have a propensity to develop into a what is described in childhood as a pure type 1 autoimmune hepatitis can develop into a pure PSC phenotype in adults with a transitional phase in between. And it simply depends what time you capture it.
But Jake, those people who carry a diagnosis of autoimmune hepatitis are under evolutionary pressure from the immunosuppression applied for their autoimmune hepatitis. I don't think that you're saying that AIH of its own burns out and goes on to PSC, or have I misunderstood you?
I don't know if we have the data to say either way, because any patient who we have the diagnosis in AIH presumably would receive immunosuppression.
That's my point. So AIH, under treatment, can develop in a PSC-like direction.
Yes.
And whether that would occur, and whether that would occur without such pressure from azathioprine and prednisolone, is a moot point. But on the other hand, you have kids who come in with a mix of autoimmune hepatitis and PSC. You can find the bile duct lesions in biopsy, and you definitely see portal tract inflammation and plasmacytosis and spillover at the limiting plate. Well, I don't know, Jake. I think that it's an open question which patients with AIH under treatment resolve and which patients shift into a cholangiopathic pattern. Is there any information on what markers, either clinical or histopathologic, point out what's going to happen to a particular kid?
Not from this paper. From a previous paper, also in JHEP reports, they do describe that patients with, they need to have type 1 autoimmune hepatitis. Certainly no patients with anti-LKM positivity developed a PSC phenotype in adulthood. The patients with a presentation, at least, with, as described, a pure AIH phenotype, tended to have slightly more advanced disease at presentation, probably reflecting perhaps the degree of hepatocellular necrosis that in response to their widespread inflammation. But exactly how you can predict at diagnosis or early on whether those patients will go on to resolve and become stable, pure AIH patients, or progress, if you want to call it progression, and move over to PSC is unclear in my mind.
Right then. So you just got the biopsy specimen back, biopsy report back. This was a kid with elevated transaminases and a medium or low elevated gamma GT. You haven't got the MRCP results in hand. But what are you going to do different, if anything, if the histopathologist says autoimmune hepatitis versus autoimmune hepatitis with features of cholangiopathy?
in the first instance, probably not very much different. If the report or the description, and particularly if there was other accompanying features like a high IgG, for example, then you would treat with immunosuppression in a similar way to other patients with AIH who haven't described the cholangiopathy. But then it would be in the back of your mind that if there was a poor response to treatment and you were escalating and escalating immunosuppression, then perhaps this is the sort of patient where you would want to request a repeat early biopsy. Rather than at any other time point, sooner than another patient, to see is there now really convincing evidence that this is less responsive to immunosuppression, and perhaps that's because they have already moved on to more of a PSC phenotype than a one that's responsive to typical corticosteroids.
Do you require a thumbs up from histopathologists before you start vancomycin or before you start ursodeoxycholic acid? Or do you require a thumbs up from an MRCP interpreter?
At least in Birmingham, where we work, we would want some evidence that there is bile duct injury, whether that is small duct or large duct, before moving down that direction.
You've got a high gamma GT. Not very high, but just a little bit elevated. Is that the result of innocent bystander damage in this inflammatory ruck within the portal tracts?
I mean, you're intentionally giving me here a slightly challenging case, but I think it would depend on how high the gamma GT is. If the gamma GT was 800, then I think that many of us would be inclined to at least start URSO in the first instance, accompanying the standard immunosuppression regime. I don't think, at least our current practice would be to start vancomycin straight out the bat, but if there was a poor response to immunosuppression and feeling that particularly accompanying large duct features on MRCP, then that would be the time we'd think about vancomycin. The caveat with this is that whilst vancomycin certainly, my interpretation of the data is that vancomycin certainly helps the colitis associated with sclerosing cholangitis, and it may help the liver enzymes, but it isn't necessarily altering the disease course. Similar for ursodeoxycholic acid.
So, in effect, you boys at the coalface could really use additional histopathologic or clinical markers to say this is a bona fide cholangiopathy and you need to get on the stick with it.
Yeah, the big decision comes is at what point do you call time on the immunosuppression? At what point do you call time on prednisolone and azathioprine and say, we are not making any progress because this is the classical autoimmune phase that was responsive to standard immunosuppression regimes has gone, and this is now a bile duct-centric injury which is not going to respond to immunosuppression. And making that call is challenging.
Well, I did mean to challenge you. And I thank you for responding in as gentlemanly a manner as you did, rather than just telling me to get lost. But in effect, these kids do better than the Swedes had expected. And I'm not certain what the expectations are for long-term survival, long-term native liver survival in PSC of childhood in Birmingham. And your caveat is absolutely well established that you can maybe able to tell something about Norwegian children or even Finnish children from these data. Danes, I don't know. Danes are special. But maybe the data can't be extrapolated beyond Scandinavia.
Yeah, and it again, I don't know enough about the referral patterns in Sweden to understand exactly the severity of this cohort. I think that the other helpful point from this is that they have provided validation of the SCOPE index, this sclerosing cholangitis and outcomes in pediatrics index, which was described a year or two ago, a relatively simple scoring system that puts people into low, medium, high risk of significant clinical outcomes in children diagnosed with sclerosing cholangitis. And they have found evidence that that scoring system seems to work in their cohort. I think the point that I will just highlight, which is a personal vendetta of mine, is that these authors seem to have used this score correctly, that they've calculated it at diagnosis as a prognostication marker. What's tempting to sometimes do in clinical practice is to recalculate someone's index score as their disease progresses, but these scores are not validated in that way. They may work in that way, but that's not necessarily the case. So,
Jake, I have been receiving hand signals from our producer that we're running over time, and I'm so sorry, because as you can tell, this subject interests me, but I don't think we can carry it further. Have we touched on everything that you'd like to touch on?
More or less.
More or less. Well, we'll go for more. Jake, thank you again. And for the listeners, thank you for following along with Jake and me as we get into a tussle in the weeds. Bye-bye now.
Thanks a lot, Alex, and we'll speak next month.